In Irma's aftermath, climate scientists sound a warning about more powerful storms to come. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9 and never miss a show. Download our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. Just ahead this morning, a closer look at climate science and strong storms. Get on the line now with your thoughts, your questions at 549-2937. Then later, lots of Vietnam veterans in this area. Not all of them are men. Female veterans of the war share their memories as PBS premieres a new Ken Burns film on the war this weekend. And it's our book club today on the show. Did you maybe read a book by candlelight when the power went out during the storm? Find out what book club leader Stacy Goldring was reading and recommends. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, the First Coast is continuing the long and difficult process of cleanup and rebuilding in the wake of Hurricane Irma. Thousands in this area are still without power. Damage from flooding, downed trees, and high winds is extensive throughout the area and the state of Florida. Governor Rick Scott is touring the flooded Black Creek region today in Clay County, one of many areas hard hit by the storm. In Irma's aftermath, the debate is once again in full swing over just how much warming oceans and rising seas are driving these increasingly powerful storms. What does climate science have to say about all this? We're going to begin the hour with a closer look as we welcome Dr. Jeff Martin. He's a climatologist and assistant professor of geography at Jacksonville University, and he joins us now in studio. Dr. Martin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. We want your calls right now as we talk about the aftermath of Hurricane, now Tropical Storm Irma. It's obviously been out of the region for a little bit now. Let us know how you're doing out there, how cleanup's going in your area, and let us know your questions about climate science as it relates to these powerful storms we're dealing with here in Florida. The number to join us, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page as well. So, Jeff Martin, after the record rainfall of Hurricane Harvey in Texas, then right behind it, Irma, with this stunning combination of extreme strength and longevity all across the state of Florida, it seems that scientists are growing ever more confident now in their messaging and their linkage of factors like worsened storm surge flooding and hurricane rainfall to climate change. You're in that camp, correct?
Yes.
And so as you look at the aftermath of Irma, as a climate scientist, can you tell us what factors contributed to the strength and destructive power of this storm?
Well, the sea surface temperatures this year are very warm. And, of course, this was a storm that you would expect at this time of year, what we call a Cape Verde or a storm that comes off the California coast. And there is increased precipitation in, I said California, I meant Africa.
West Africa, right.
Yeah, there's increased precipitation in West Africa now, so that's inducing more of these systems. There's a couple of waves that have come. And so this is a storm that that was very intense. These are the storms that you expect to be the most intense from all the origins in the Atlantic. But this was indeed a very strong storm.
Yes, and the debate over hurricanes and climate change seems to be, as we would have expected, incredibly partisan. The EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, is saying this week it's insensitive to raise climate policy as we deal with the impact of these storms. What about that?
Well, you know, in the last 15 years, we've had Katrina. We have had Sandy. So this isn't the first one. We just had Harvey, followed very quickly by Irma, and we don't know what the cost of those two storms are going to be. But I imagine that the combination of the two will be greater than Sandy. And so the cost of these things have got to be making somebody think in the government that perhaps it would be better to mitigate or at least prepare for such storms. And I think we may be past the point of doing anything other than preparing, than emissions control and things like that.
Think we're past the point of no return when we look at our warming planet?
I think we could be. I think we should expect it to see increased temperatures for at least 30 years. I don't know that we can do it through merely emissions control. I don't know if we have the willpower to do it merely through emissions control. So I think at this point we may be looking at mitigation practices, no construction. I know the Dutch do great work. New York has been looking at their engineering processes and trying to replicate some of those, but those are going to be costly too. So, you know, it's a function, I believe, of the willpower of the public.
Until the public demands a much stronger response to reduce carbon emissions, you mean, you're saying our best bet to get through more of these storms is just better preparation for the storms.
And that's going to be costly and interfering as well. So, you know, the infrastructure that's required for that, just imagine the work that's done on 95. You know, you're going to have those types of interferences with life associated with preparing for that type of infrastructure. So that's going to be costly as well. So it's the public's willpower over almost all of these issues.
It's 549-2937 as we speak with climatologist Jeff Martin of Jacksonville University about warming oceans, rising sea levels, and hurricanes. Give us a call with your thoughts and questions. So, as I've been hearing over the last few days, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I've heard other climate scientists speak out over the last several days and say it's not accurate to say that Irma was caused by climate change. It is accurate to theorize that its extreme strength and intensity and its size were exacerbated in part by warming oceans driven by climate change. Is that right?
That is correct. That's a very good way of stating it. You can't pin climbing event on one event or one event on climbing event, but you can pin patterns. You can see the strength of the sea surface temperatures right now, and that's going to be associated with overall global warming or climate change. And that's regardless of the source of global warming or climate change. You know, those types of things are going to be expected. We're also in a period of heightened tropical storm activity. We had a period of previous decades when we had fewer storms and less activity, and Florida looked wide open for the taking. You know, people moved here and people moved to the coast, and so the population exploded, and now we have to deal with the population in harm's way as well because we have heightened tropical storm activity.
And we've got a bad situation here with massive coastal development. It does not mix well with rising seas and ever stronger storms. We also have a state where top officials have not accepted climate science, the reality of climate science. What about that? This combination of factors for Florida, in particular, out of all of the 50 states, is extremely troublesome, I think, to climate scientists like yourself.
I think in all issues related to the environment, it's always the environment versus the economy. And what the public or our public leaders seem to address right now is that the economy is more important. And that usually is. That's where the public usually stands. But again, if we start assuming all these costs of this continued storm damage, that policy may change. Who knows? Maybe Governor Scott will have a different attitude in if there's another storm that impacts Florida this year. Also, they're inviting so much migration to Florida as well. All of Florida is within 100 miles of the coast. And so, you know, all of Florida is threatened.
South Florida in particular, when you look at climate models going out 20, 30, 40, 50 years, the worst case scenarios are apocalyptic, quite frankly. They show the bottom half of the Florida Peninsula underwater. Nothing is done, if we do not radically change our policies.
Well, you do have to recognize that climate change is a natural phenomenon, and that's happened before. You know, Florida it contracts and expands through natural processes, like the last ice age, as an example, and we are in a warming period now. But with human activity, we are exacerbating that right now. So perhaps.
And the debate seems to be just how much is human activity contributing. Some people believe it's contributing a lot. Some people think maybe not quite so much.
It's not an easy question. It really isn't. And science is working very hard to solve that question. But science is also a very demanding taskmaster. So the standards for saying that it is absolutely human or anthropogenic induced at this percentage level or at this confidence level is a difficult call. So that's part of the problem.
But more than 90% of climate scientists accept the reality of human activity contributing to climate change, right? There's debate within the scientific community about the degree.
Positive and negative feedback mechanisms. Solar dimming, is that going to have an impact? Increased evaporation and water vapor in the atmosphere, or H2O in the gaseous. Those are all questions to be resolved. You know, we have models, but the models always haven't been correct in the past, and that's part of the problem. And the reason the models aren't always correct or the forecasts aren't always correct is because we are learning as we go. Solar dimming would be a classic example of that.
Let's go to your calls as we speak with climatologist Jeff Martin in the aftermath of Irma, 549-2937. Patrick on Fleming Island. Hi, Patrick. How'd you do during the storm? What's your question?
We didn't do well. We're still without power down on Fleming Island.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
I live on the river. It was about 2 feet higher than we have ever seen in 30 years down there.
Right.
Our point, if you have eyes, we can see now that we have, Hurricane Sandy was not only in New York, it was in New York in November. If you look in the Midwest, we always know they have tornadoes, but not in February. Now we have the world has changed, and we all know it. And if you're a denier, it's because it's a political thing, and you just don't want to do that. But think about the money impact. In the last year alone, we're going to go over $100 billion. Imagine if we'd taken that $100 billion and put it towards alternative energies and made it work. And this isn't going to be the last one. It's going to happen again and again and again until finally, after we rub everybody's nose in it and go, look, this is happening. We've got to do something. And when I think about how many people it will employ to change over, how many problems this solves, instead of causes, it just seems like a no-brainer. And I'm just waiting for politicians to get some guts and stand up to the Limbaughs and the right that keep telling them that what they're seeing is not what they're seeing. And I'm just waiting for some strong political leadership from the right, and I just haven't seen it.
Thanks, Patrick. Dr. Martin.
Well, the only thing that I would add to that, when you talk about the extreme events that we've experienced in the past 2 decades. One of the things you have to recognize is that abnormal weather is normal. We expect to have extreme events. So the question for science is this frequency of extreme events, is the intensity of extreme events caused by specific phenomena, either CO2 emissions or whatever, and that's a difficult call. But what you are saying is absolutely correct. We are seeing all of these events, and to the common eye, the hypothesis would be at this point is that there is some type of human input or anthropogenic input. Even if it isn't, can you really take the chance and let it go as is and continue to see these types of storms?
And in particular for Florida, I've seen articles published in the last couple of days with headlines like "A Requiem for Florida," "Elegy for the Sunshine State." This concept that what is happening here in our state is simply not sustainable over a longer period of time. Here's a quote from one of the articles that was sent to me: "Living in Florida, you don't have to be a genius to realize that what is happening isn't sustainable, that Florida isn't meant to have so many people all jammed together so near the coasts. And the whole idea that we're courting disaster over the long term if we continue the way we always have here in Florida. Do you agree with that?
Is that addressed to me?
Yes.
Yes, I do. I think, and we continue to invite people to come down. Development, of course, is our biggest industry. And we continue to invite people down. The elderly continue to come down. They're one of the most vulnerable groups of people. We're since World War II, we're the fastest growing state in the country. We are now over New York, the third largest state in the country. And the question is, can our landscape, can our geography support that?
To be clear, Florida's not alone. Look at what Superstorm Sandy did to New York.
And
the whole coastline is at risk.
Well, let me go on and say that this is both a local and a global problem. Look what's happening in Bangladesh. You know, look what's happening in the Ganges River of India. You know, these are in typhoons that hit Asia and China. These are global issues.
The Seychelles projected to be underwater before too much longer.
Yeah.
That whole chain of islands.
That is correct. And it's also in a very prone tropical storm region.
We're talking with climatologist Jeff Martin right now in the aftermath of Irma. Let us know how you're doing out there and give us a call with your questions at 549-2937. Tom is on the west side. Hi, Tom.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I just want to say that I was here for Dora, and that was a major storm that hit Jacksonville. By comparison, Dora was a minnow compared to this storm. And this storm was a rather distant mist from Jacksonville and did comparable damage. I think anyone who doesn't believe that climate change is involved in these things is just not paying attention.
Thanks, Tom. And when you think back to Dora, what are your main memories?
And I was pretty young. I don't have a whole lot of memories about it, but it was kind of scary.
Yeah, I'm sure. Especially when you were a young guy living through that. Thanks for that, Tom. Jeff Martin, if you were in charge of policy for Florida, and you said, you know, a minute ago you said mitigation, preparation are so important. What should Florida be doing differently in your view?
Well, one thing, we're going to have to put a lot of money into some solutions. Right now, South Florida, specifically Miami, which is our most densely populated region, is suffering from saltwater intrusion largely because of sea level rise. And those are real world issues that they are facing right now.
And at the county level down there, they've already started aggressive mitigation and preparation plans. They've sort of gone around the state government and they're just doing it on their own.
And my understanding is that they are indeed going around and that they have hurdles from higher levels of government to keep them from doing the types of things and keep them from getting the money that's doing the types of things that they need to do that. Now, we're going to have saltwater intrusion up in northeast Florida and Jacksonville along the St. Johns River. It's a different type of saltwater intrusion, but it's still going to be saltwater intrusion. So we're going to have to face that issue as well. And at the same time, talking about the economy versus the environment, they're talking about dredging the St. Johns River, which is going to further exacerbate the saltwater intrusion. So,
and saltwater intrusion damages what? Let's talk about these are things that people might not think of when you talk about this, but saltwater intrusion can do a lot of damage in unseen ways. Can you tell me what they are?
Well, we get about 90% of our water from the groundwater source, from the aquifers. So if you start getting saltwater intrusion into those aquifers, which is what we're talking about in South Florida, you're going to start sucking up or pumping up saltwater versus freshwater. That's one of the things that you're going to have to consider. So what that's going to make us have to do is start looking at surface water sources, fresh surface waters like the St. Johns River. So if we start pumping water out of the St. Johns River, we're going to start reducing discharge downstream. That's going to introduce saltwater intrusion into the St. Johns further south to Palatka. That's going to change the ecosystems along that that river system because it is not a salt-tolerant environment. It's a freshwater environment. So all of these things are interrelated. And Orlando is already having problems with their water because it's such a fast-growing place. What I mean by their water, their water availability. So they're looking at going to pumping it out of the St. John's.
A couple of tweets coming into the show. Adam, if facts haven't changed the minds of climate change deniers, what will? How can we approach this discussion? I'll have you answer that in a minute. But first, let's go to Eric on the south side. Hi, Eric.
Good morning, Melissa. And thanks for your coverage during the storm. It was very helpful to hear your voice.
Thank you. Glad you were with us.
You had Brian Teeples, the director of the Northeast Florida Regional Planning Council, on some months ago, and just to tease you a little bit, you had a bit of a verbal gasp when he talked about Florida's population going to 40 and 50 million in another 30 years. It's now at 20 million. I've seen it grow from 50 million in 1950, and your guest has addressed the population issues. I wonder, by about 2150, people will think, you know, golly, those people back in the turn of the century, they just kept trying, and storm after storm, and then not only tens of thousands of people were killed, but some many tens of thousands, and finally they begin to depopulate. Because we're going to have 40 million people in Florida by 2045. We're going to have another doubling. So we need to, as your guest has addressed, what do we do? Mm-hmm. And again, thanks for your show, Melissa.
Thank you, Eric. Jeff Martin.
You're absolutely right. I would like to get back to the previous tweet, I think it was, about what do the science skeptics. Now, I'm going to be a little defensive of the science skeptics here because science is a very demanding taskmaster. And if you want to verify a hypothesis as being theory, you know, you have to have a level of confidence that is going to be accepting. So, scientists are very strict in their standards. So I can understand now, again, the body of the community is accepting it as anthropogenic or human. But
his question was more about how do you convince the average Joe out there? I mean, this phenomenon of huge portions of the population just not accepting what the scientific community is saying.
Well, I think events like this, you know, to somebody in Iowa, they have no impact. To somebody in Indiana, they have no impact. We talked about tornadoes and other mid-latitude cyclones that can have snowstorms that can have a real big impact there. Those types of events start when they start witnessing those types of events, then that may turn them. It's hard. It's so unfortunate to have to say that it takes a catastrophic event like this to.
And then finally, right. And then finally, the last caller, is Florida going down the wrong path by continuing to encourage so many people to move here?
Well, that's gosh, yes. You know, I just don't. And I've been thinking that for a decade or decades or more now. And we're not the only people doing it.
Yeah.
Eastern Texas is doing it. And, of course, Harvey just impacted Eastern Texas. So this southern tier air conditioning has brought everybody to the south. And that's where we're having some of the major atmospheric natural disasters. We have earthquakes in California where there's large population centers. So it's not just Florida, but certainly Florida has to be highlighted in this population growth debate.
We'll continue to follow it as we cover climate issues on the show regularly. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
He's Dr. Jeff Martin, climatologist and assistant professor of geography at JU. Much more still ahead. We'll be right back.
World Affairs Council and UNF partnering to engage citizens in becoming better informed participants in the global community. September 19th, Christopher Cox, The New Global Economic Reality, How North Korea and Terrorism Play Key Roles. Information, worldaffairscouncil.jax.org.
ServPro of Jacksonville South and Arlington reminds you that water damage can happen fast. Be prepared for this year's storm season with emergency plans and service numbers on hand. 721-2230. ServPro of Jacksonville South and Arlington. Like it never even happened.
On the next Jazz Night in America, Eddie Palmieri and Harlem River Drive.
And my problem with Harlem River Drive is that I wanted a crossover. And you know who were my biggest fans? The anti-government movement, the Weathermen.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, the risk of nuclear war with North Korea. We talk with New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos, who spent 4 days in Pyongyang last month, where he says talk of nuclear war is everywhere, including on TV and billboards. We'll talk about why this has become an especially risky time and where it might lead. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. A quick update for you coming into our 89.9 newsroom. The Legends Center is the only shelter still open in Duval County in the aftermath of Irma. Other shelters have closed. If you need to get to the Legends Center, you can. It is still open over on Soutelle, both for special needs and general population refugees from the storm. In other news now, iconic documentary filmmaker Ken Burns is out this month with his much-anticipated new series. It's called The Vietnam War, a film by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, and it premieres here on WJCT Television Sunday night, September 17th. This is a 10-part, 18-hour documentary series that tells the epic story of one of the most divisive events in American history as you've never seen it before on film. Lots of local veterans in our area, of course, will be watching with intense interest, including female veterans of Vietnam. Yes, there were lots of women there during the war, and this morning we welcome two of them to share their thoughts and memories. Renee Johnson and Margie Yarborough both join us now in studio. They were part of the Donut Dollies contingent in Vietnam. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And, you know, this is the untold story of the American women who volunteered to go to Vietnam on this really impossible mission, try to help the troops forget about the war, the Donut Dollies. I had never heard of them before, and I thought I knew a lot about Vietnam. My dad served in Vietnam, but I had never heard of this. This is just an amazing story. You volunteered to serve through the Red Cross. Renee, tell me how you got involved with this, and tell me a little bit about your experience.
Well, my father was military, and he'd been in Vietnam in 62 and 63 and came back very opposed to our participation. I was in college, and of course, the campus thing was, it's an immoral war, it's a terrible war. But at the same time, I was dating men at Fort Benning who had also been there that thought we belonged there. So I wanted to go find out for myself why we were there. That mission was not accomplished, but I did find out that I could do something productive while I was against the war, but I could support the troops. So it was a win-win for me just to go over to provide a touch of home, which is our kind of slang logo, and to give them just a few minutes of respite away from the war. It was a year of mostly highs and occasional low. It was a job where my morning commute was in a helicopter, usually with the doors open. And who could beat that if you're 21 years old?
Right.
We faced the same dangers that a lot of the guys did, not the ones in the field, but back at the bases. But we didn't think about that so much. It was, we were there to smile, to laugh, and to get them to smile and laugh, and that was the main intent.
Yeah, and just try to get their minds off what they were dealing with, put on shows and things like that.
Little game-type activities. Not, we weren't performers. We didn't sing and dance, but, well, some of them did,
Some of them did. Margie, you were 21 years old, 1968, when this all started for you. Is that right?
That's correct.
What happened?
Well, I had graduated early from college, and I was teaching first grade on an island in the Ohio River. And I was watching television at that Christmas, and Bob Hope would do a tour through military bases and zones and so forth every year, and that they would broadcast it at Christmas time. So I was watching the Bob Hope special, and there were these girls dressed in blue dresses that he was chatting with and laughing with, and they were introduced as Red Cross recreation workers. And I thought, that looks like fun. So The following day in the newspaper was an ad advertising for people to come, young women to come and interview for that position. And I thought the timing was perfect. So I went and interviewed and got accepted. And the next thing I knew, I was off that island in the Ohio River, and I was headed to Vietnam the following summer.
You landed in Saigon, July of 69?
Yes.
And then what?
Everybody landed in Saigon, and at that point you got your assignment where you were to go throughout the country. There were two basic different types of tasks. One was to man recreation centers, which were back at the major bases, and then the other was the airborne section, where you flew out every day in a helicopter to a fire base or just wherever there were soldiers. And that's when you put on what we called a show, but think about it more as a TV game show. So we were tasked with organizing that, creating it, designing it, writing it, making the props, packing them all in a big canvas bag. They were to last anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour, and then we took them out into the field.
How much did the troops enjoy that?
I think we had a lot of good participation. I will tell you that there were a lot of blank stares and open mouths when we would land, because these guys had just come in from being out in the boonies for up to a month at a time, and all suddenly there's a round eye standing there saying, "Hi, I'm Margie. I'm from Pennsylvania. Where are you from?"
So surreal.
Yeah.
And you were known as the Donut Dollies. What did that mean?
Well, that was left over from World War II, when they had Red Cross Clubmobile workers that used converted trucks and buses that had donut machines and coffee machines that they literally drove around, first in England and then after D-Day into Europe. And sometimes they were actually ahead of the troops. So when the front moved, they were already there. But they were called Donut Dollies. Then the program continued into Korea in 53 after the peace accords were signed. And again, they made donuts. Well, there they were luckier. They had staff to make the donuts. We did not have donuts in our job description.
You didn't serve donuts.
We didn't serve donuts. Guys will say they got donuts from us, and maybe because sometimes some of the mess sergeants would make donuts when we were coming so we could hand them out. But we did that.
It was a leftover name from World War II. Interesting.
Yeah, the Red Cross didn't like it, but to us it was an affectionate term.
Right. And when you look back on that year you spent in Vietnam, it's been, 50 years almost, as this Ken Burns film prepares to premiere, what are your emotions as you prepare to have a reckoning of that era? And we're going to see some incredible footage and interviews on PBS of this war.
I really did not have any strong feelings one way or the other about the United States involvement in Vietnam before I went over there. I guess I was rather naive at that point. What I did know was that the men needed to be supported. So I was there to support them, not our war effort. And I think I did that, and I learned a lot from that. It was the first time that I had been around the world. It was the first time that I had been put in situations where I had to think on my feet. So that was a good thing. But when I came back, I kind of compartmentalized it. I had learned different talents over there that I've used the rest of my life. But I no longer followed it closely every day. And now it's just something that happened in my past.
Mm-hmm. Renee?
Well, I was fortunate enough to, a week ago, see excerpts from episodes 3 to 10. And I was very impressed with what they've done. They're giving this show a different perspective. They're not interviewing the same people that have been on all the other shows in the past. It's really different. There were scenes that were very hard for me, and I think for some of the veterans, they need to be aware that it might trigger some issues, but I think it's really well done. I think it's a side of the story that needs to be told, and I have stayed very, well, not the whole time, but at least since the mid-80s, I've been very involved with veterans groups and veterans things. Unlike Margie, I didn't put it behind me. I came home, but not completely. And I think this is going to be, maybe for some people, closure, maybe for some people, something different. But I think Burns and Novick did a wonderful job with it.
Oh, for sure. And I can't wait to see it. And I thank you both so much for sharing your memories and insights. It's just fascinating to hear your stories. Thank you, ladies, for being here today.
Well, thanks for having us.
We appreciate it.
They are Renee Johnson and Margie Yarborough, part of the Donut Dollies relief effort during the Vietnam War. Make sure to tune in to WJCT Television this Sunday night at 8 p.m., September 17th, for the premiere of The Vietnam War, a film by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. That's 8 p.m. Sunday. We'll be right back.
Leading figures you can in the field of economic justice. Then think a little bit harder.
I do think certain individuals come to the planet missioned. And she's definitely one of those great souls that came here, you know, with a mission.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here's a hint. Si se puede. Next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Folk, blues, jazz, R&B, country, western, Americana. It's all acoustic and it's all in one place. And that one place is String Theory. And you can hear String Theory Friday nights at 11 p.m. only on 89.9 WJCT. String Theory, the very best of modern acoustic music. This and every Friday night at 11 p.m. on WJCT.
Sit back, relax, and travel back in time with 89.9 on Sunday nights beginning at 7 with Radio Theater.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe.
Doo-wop Revival.
Good evening, I'm Glenn Fisher, the king of the doo-woppers.
Relax Radio. Throwback Sunday, Sunday nights beginning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT. Online at WJCT.org. Looking forward to looking back.
Welcome back. Well, during the hurricane, when power went out and you couldn't watch TV or use your phone, maybe you had to be sitting home by candlelight. Did you do something really old-fashioned and crack a book? That's right, an actual book, not an e-book, not a Kindle, a book with pages you have to turn. I bet some of you did. Maybe you got your kids to sit down and read, too. Books are your friend in good times and bad. This morning in our first Coast Connect Book Club, our leader Stacey Goldring joins us with a look at a classic, Catch-22. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm good. And Catch-22 is, it's got to be on the top 50 lists of the best books of all time.
You know how I am with numbers, but I believe it's number 7 on Modern Libraries list.
Right.
And it's one of these books that I would never read unless I had to, and I am so grateful that I did. The word Catch-22 comes from this book. Heller, Joseph Heller,
the author. Joseph Heller.
Right, coined this term. And Catch-22 comes from a situation in the book where we have our main character, Yossarian. He doesn't want to fly any more missions because he's afraid that he will die. So he goes to the doc and says, I don't want to fly any more missions. And the doc says, okay, but you realize that if you tell me that, that shows that you are sane and you are capable of flying. You can only not fly if you're crazy. And so there's this catch 22 where you have to do, it's kind of like,
You're damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Or go find your glasses. Well, I could find my glasses if I could put on my glasses in order to find my glasses.
So, exactly.
And you know, catch 22 kind of applies to what happened this week in Jacksonville. Do you leave?
Or do you stay?
Or do you stay? It's a catch 22.
And you're not, either choice is not good.
No, because we're still, you know, people are flooded out. People have lost life. I mean, it's bad all the way around, but we have Heller to thank. But why is it so important? And why would I urge people to read such an incredibly uncomfortable book? Because you are reading a book that was written about World War II, written during the Korean conflict, and became a soul book for those entering the Vietnam era. What does Heller do in this book that makes it so magical is that not only does he combine three generations of America in one, but he deconstructs what a novel is and he puts it back together again. And everyone is uncomfortable because they don't know what they're reading. Because just like in war, you're being shot at all the time. When you read the pages of this book, you're being shot at all the time. You don't know what's going to happen next. And in addition to this, we're dealing with death. We're dealing with entrails. We are dealing with horror. And we're dealing with humor. And the juxtaposition of humor and horror is handled so well at the pen of Heller. He is an artist. And no one had ever experienced this before. However, if you had experienced war, you understood Catch-22. So all these veterans coming back, they get it. These people who are experiencing the Korean conflict, they get it. And those going into Vietnam understand it as well. So he embraces three generations of America. And not only are we trying to understand the new shape of a novel, because he comes along right at the same time as Kurt Vonnegut and these types of Thomas Pynchon, these types of artists who are almost trying to understand dystopia. It's happening in America, because what happens during Korea, MacArthur gets a little bit fired. Why? Because Truman's saying one thing, he's saying another. MacArthur comes back to America, and instead of obeying what Truman says and, you know, having troops go to A instead of B, MacArthur goes on a speaking tour and says, that guy's nuts. He's going to kill people. So all of a sudden, all these vets, all America during World War II, Uncle Sam, I want you, is hearing MacArthur question authority. And then we have the McCarthy hearings. This book encapsulates all of this distrust of whoever is in charge, with incredible humor. You will laugh at every single page. It's
incredible. We need to laugh right now.
Oh, we need to laugh. We all need to read Catch-22. And if you go down to the San Marco bookstore, they have this book in their window, just like this. The original cover, which barely sold. Only the paperback, when they put a picture of a soldier with some airplanes in the back, then it took off.
Then it took off.
Yeah, this did not appeal.
Well, and you've got an incredibly well-used, dog-eared, post-it noted copy of it right there with all sorts of
if we had time and if
highlights
I could stay
on
in
it.
This air-conditioned studio, it feels so good in here. I would read every single, I would read everything I've dog-eared, but I know we don't have a lot of time for that.
I know, and I'm so sorry about that. Yeah. But let's take a minute, though, to explain that we do a monthly book club on the show with our leader, Stacey Goldring. Stacey has an actual physical book club at the San Marco bookstore where you can come out to her regular discussions on books. And our book of the month is Catch-22.
And the library will have it.
That's right. Our partner in our book club is the Jacksonville Public Library. So go to the library and check out a copy of Catch-22. They provide extra copies of Stacey's picks for our listeners. Isn't that cool?
Enjoy. Really, enjoy. It'll be a rough ride. You can books at chapternotes.com if you want to complain, but you need to read it. You need to have it under your belt. You need to.
And you need to follow Stacey. Go to her website, chapterendnotes.com. And if you have an idea about our book club, a book you'd like us to discuss, email Stacey.
Please, yeah, that'd be great.
At bookclub@wjct.org, bookclub@wjct.org. thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Hope your AC comes back on
Thank
soon.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay, finally this hour, we want to tell you about a fascinating new exhibit chronicling the tragic demise of those iconic springs of the Ocklawaha River in north central Florida. The Lost Springs Project debuts tomorrow on the UNF campus, and another exhibition is also set to appear at MoCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art, Jacksonville. This is a collaboration between Gainesville painter Margaret Ross Tolbert and St. Augustine-based environmental filmmaker Matt Keen. We have a preview right now as we welcome Jim Draper. He's UNF's Gallery of Art coordinator. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And in the aftermath of this storm, Florida, of course, is focused pretty heavily on our water situation, our natural resources. This is a fascinating project, the Lost Springs. Can you tell us a little bit about what people will learn when they come out and see this?
Well, it is about water. And I think that Florida, the thing that we realize every day about the, if in Florida, if we don't embrace hydrology, we're just not getting it. So this issue, the Ocklawaha River was considered one of the most beautiful rivers in the world until this kind of wrong, bad idea of doing the Cross Florida Barge Canal happened in the 60s. And the landscape there was forever changed. It's just some people refer to the Ocklawaha as and the feminine as that she, which she is a very lovely river, and it's just like a boot across her throat when they put the Kirkpatrick Dam in that formed the Rodman Impoundment. Every 4 years, they draw down the water to keep the right now it's kind of just a pool that has a lot of plants in it, so that to kill the plants they draw the water down, and the river comes back, it falls back into its natural course, and these gorgeous springs just start pumping turquoise again. So you realize that there's this world that's been inundated that comes to life again,
and it's only available every 4 years, when they open up the dam.
It would be like losing your grandmother and then having her resurrected for a couple of weeks a year for the rest of your life.
And why do they only open it every 4 years?
The reason they open it is to kill the subaquatic, the submerged vegetation. And then, so they let it die and then they fill the water back up and then it's a bizarre system.
And there's this incredible fight in Florida over the Ocklawaha and whether to allow it to be natural again. This is basically, this exhibit is documenting the fight for the springs. Is that right?
Yes. It's talking about the restoration of the river, letting the river flow back into its original channel. Margaret Tolbert and Matt Keen, and a lot of us have worked on this project for years. I was first alerted by Karen Ollers, who's been a champion of. She as a child watched the demise of the Ocklawaha, and so she's been fighting her entire life. So, her and Karen Chadwick and Erica Ritter and these women have really worked for their entire lives to restore the Ocklawaha.
People can learn about this and come out and view this exhibit in a couple of places. Can you tell us how people can access this?
Yes, if you go, the exhibits are at MoCA. The Margaret Ross Tolbert's paintings will be exhibited at MoCA. That opens the 24th of September, and that day, Sunday afternoon, we'll premiere the film. Lost Springs will premiere at 1:30 and at 2:30. You can also go to the MoCA website. You can go to the UNF website for the Lufrano Gallery. The exhibition, there's another exhibition that will be on campus at the Lufrano Intercultural Gallery. Which
starting tomorrow.
Well, it's starting tomorrow. The reception, we've moved to the 21st just because of the storm. We've had some issues with the artists getting work together. So we'll actually have the reception a week from tomorrow. The storm has kind of interrupted all of our campus activities.
Sure. Certainly interrupted a lot of things. But two opportunities to check out Lost Springs, both on the UNF campus and at MoCA.
Yes.
Through September, and then actually through the rest of the year, you can look at the paintings at Mocha, it's really an interesting way that art is being used to highlight an important Florida issue.
I think so, and I think it ultimately it's just like Catch-22. I think that the story becomes told by the artist. I think that facts and figures can go to a certain you can get certain information from facts and figures, but I think the story has to be told ultimately by artists, and I think this is a good one. We'll also have some panel discussions November 2nd at MoCA's, and we'll have another screening and a panel discussion, so it would be a good time to come out and actually talk about this these issues. So.
Keep your eye out for Lost Springs. The project is debuting this month on the UNF campus and at MoCA Jacksonville as artists speak out. One of our most beloved local artists, Jim Draper, here to share it with us. It's so good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
He's Jim Draper, artist and UNF Gallery of Art coordinator. Again, that's the Lost Springs project debuting tomorrow on the UNF campus at the Lufrano Gallery, and then also paintings up this month and more multimedia opportunities happening at MoCA Jacksonville. All right, that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen to our podcast anytime. You can also get us on iTunes. Next on 1A, many places in the Caribbean will have to rebuild from scratch after the devastating impact of Irma. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.